There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon, and I am thrilled to have you here today. Of all days, I'm always thrilled to have you here on the program, but I'm really thrilled to have you here with me today because today we are all thrilled to give the year 2020 the swift kick in the groin it deserves, as we are now ushering in the year 2021. Happy New Year. I hope you had a fun ushering in of the new year. And I hope you're still doing things smartly, safely. As I've mentioned before, yeah, there's a lot of positive news about defeating the coronavirus. Vaccines are out there, albeit slowly getting administered. And there is a light at the end of the tunnel. There is some hope. Looks like things may eventually turn around in 2021 with that. Still going to take a few months. You know, let's be honest here. It's still going to be at least spring or summer before we start seeing the effects of the vaccine takeover. But hopefully you've done a safe introduction to 2021. And hopefully that light at the end of the tunnel does come to reality and we can start getting back to some sense of normalcy moving forward after a very tumultuous year. But we're heading into 2021. Happy to be here. Happy to be talking baseball cards with you. And we've got some real classic cardboard to discuss this time around. In fact, it's classic cardboard about classic cardboard. Yes, 30 years ago, the fine folks at Topps released not the first archive set. I'll tell you about the original archive set that actually came out in the early 80s, but the most impactful archive set based on one of the most impactful sets in baseball card history. And some collectors will say it is the best set that has ever been produced. Now, that's an arguable point there. You can make a case for other sets from roughly around the same era. But you're not going to find too many people who think that the 1953 Topps set, you're not going to find too many people who say that that's a bad set. Now, the 53 Topps set is a legendary set. We've discussed it before. The second set under the guidance of Cy Berger, actually the third set, but the second set based on the new standards of a baseball card, that being a larger card, full color on the front, statistics on the back, completely different from what baseball cards were in the late 1940s and beginning of the 1950s, certainly different from what the competition in Bowman was offering up at the time. And the 1953 Topps cards feature full color paintings based off of photographs of players, team logos, rather unique and simple design, pretty active back to the card too with those statistics and a little bit of narrative about the player's life, a fun cartoon as well. And Topps decided in 1991 to pay homage to the 1953 Topps set with the 1991 Topps archive set, what was billed as the ultimate 1953 Topps set. And what do you mean by ultimate set? Well, the Topps archive set was a 337 card reprint of the original set. Now, the original Topps set wasn't 337 cards. It was actually 274 cards. And Topps basically reprinted 273 of those 274 cards. I'll tell you about the holdout later on in the program. But then added on 57 cards that were called cards that never were. So Hank Aaron didn't have his rookie card in 1953. Well, with this reprint set, Topps was able to recreate what a 53 Topps Hank Aaron rookie card would look like, as well as other cards, Hall of Fame inductees Al Simmons, Dizzy Dean, and a unique story about a young woman who actually signed a contract with the minor league Harrisburg Senators in 1952, a 24-year-old named Eleanor Engel. She never played, obviously, in the major leagues, and her story is often lost in the cracks in the sidewalk of time. But there is an Eleanor Engel card in the reprint set, and the cards that never were differed from the designs of the regular cards. Instead of painting a picture for the card, Topps in 1991 just took a black and white photograph of the person that was featured on the card, such as Eleanor Engel or Hank Aaron or any of the others, and basically just applied that picture to the 1953 Topps design. So a nod to the past, a little bit of cleaning up on cards that should have been or could have been that were prohibitive for whatever reason. And that first big step to what ultimately became known as the Topps Heritage Set. Now, it would take several years for Topps to take the successes and the lessons learned of the Topps Archive Set from 1991 to create Topps Heritage in the early 2000s. But make no mistake, the Topps Archives release of 1991 was a major step forward in discovering what you can and can't do with a reprint set. And on top of that, the appetite for a throwback set. And there was a lot going on in 1991 that really brought about the desire for a throwback set. And we'll get into some of those details in just a little bit. And also a tip of the hat to one of our listeners, Joshua Fennell, who suggested several weeks ago on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter timeline that we do a show about reprint cards. And we're very glad that we could do that show, because this is one of those kind of side paths to card collecting, and one that often gets overlooked. And that is because a lot of people, including yours truly, I never got into the reprint cards because they weren't the real thing. I was never truly interested in a fabrication of the original card. And this comes from somebody who was once gifted a book featuring a bunch of pull-out, insert cards, basically, that were all reprint cards. And it was a collection of Hall of Fame cards, going back to the 1930s, the Gowdy cards, and, throughout some of the biggest names of the 1950s and 60s. I had that book. It sat on my bookshelf for many, many years. I think I donated it a long time ago. I never really got into the reprints, but a lot of collectors enjoy the reprints, not only because it's a quick and easy way to have a hands-on look at some of the older baseball cards that are out there, but it is certainly much more affordable than some of the actual cards. If you want a 53 Topps Mickey Mantle, if you want the real deal, you are shelling out thousands of dollars to get one. Where if you go online and dig around for a card on the 1991 Topps Archive set, you can find one certainly not for tens of thousands of dollars, but for maybe just a few bucks, unless somebody actually went through the process of getting it graded. And there are some graded prices for these cards, but card number 82, 1953 Topps Mickey Mantle, it'll cost you an arm and a leg. Card number 82, 53 Topps Archives, 1991 Topps Archives of the 53 Topps Mantle, might just be a few dollars, depending on where you get it. And I can also tell you, as somebody who has actually done this, these reprint cards do make nice cards to get autographed. So let's say, for example, and I'm trying to think of somebody who is alive. Well, let's say that you have a reprint of a 1965 Topps Pete Rose, and you want Pete Rose to autograph that card. Well, you can have that reprint autographed by Pete Rose, and you can frame it and say, hey, I had Pete Rose sign a baseball card. And you're not feeling guilty about Pete Rose autographing a real 65 Topps card, which in, you know, near mint condition would cost you several hundred dollars. So you can actually use these reprint cards for autograph purposes. And I actually did that once from the handful of 91 Topps archives cards that I had when I was a kid. One of the cards I had was Eddie Matthews. And I sent off the Eddie Matthews archives card to Eddie Matthews. This was back in 2000, and had him autograph it. He's mailed it back to me. It was one of the greatest things he could have done, free of charge too, by the way. I still have it. And the bittersweet part of this story is I received this card probably about 2 months before Eddie Matthews passed away. And very few people remember this, but Eddie Matthews died on the same day that Dale Earnhardt died at the Daytona 500. So often Eddie Matthews' death is overlooked by many people because the death of Dale Earnhardt happened on the same day. And it's unfortunate because Eddie Matthews had such a great story, but I just wanted to share that story because even though I was not a big fan of the reprint cards, I have utilized them for autographs, and they're very nice. So you can certainly do that with whether it's a 91 Topps archives card, or again, you know, not too many people that were featured in the 1953 set are still alive. But whether it was the 91 Topps archives set, or, you know, a future Topps Heritage set, maybe it's a reprint card or a throwback card, they're great for autographs. So again, want to thank our fans for making a great suggestion there. Really appreciate that. So we're going to talk a little bit about reprint cards, and specifically the 1991 Topps archives card that focused on the 1953 Topps set. Now, before we do that, quick little housekeeping note here. I want to thank everybody who's been with us over the last 4 years now that we've been doing this show, albeit with a little bit of a break that I took in between different seasons of the show, if you will, for a few months. But we've been going strong in season two, if you will, for a little over 2 years now. And we're going to continue going into 2021. Got a lot of exciting things to talk about in the next few weeks. Our next program, which will be coming your way 2 weeks from today, Friday, January 15th, will focus on the 1993 Donruss set. Again, a listener suggestion that we focus on the 92, 93, and 94 Donruss sets in separate shows. We recently did 92 Donruss. A lot of fans of that particular set, as 90s nostalgia continues to roar on as we're in 2021 now. And we'll go back and look at the 1993 Donruss set, another fine work of art. Now, 2 weeks after that, Friday, January 29th, we're going to take a look at a really unique product, one of those things I stumbled upon while scouring eBay, a product that I didn't even know existed. It had a very short existence, clearly was not too popular because it only lasted 1 year, but there is a very interesting backstory to it. This was called the Topps Heads Up Collection. Now, these weren't cards. These were roughly 5 inches in length, little cardboard cutout heads of famous baseball players. So from 1990, we have, I believe it was 26 players, not one for each team, strangely, but you could purchase this 5-inch floating cardboard head, and you could either affix it to your wall via a suction cup, which came with the card, or there were some adhesive strips on the back, so you would peel the paper off and then just stick it to your wall or your door, or as advertised on the wrapper, your high school locker door, you know, something like that. Basically, it was a predecessor to what we know as the fat head today. And there's a number of reasons why it worked and why it didn't work. And we'll get into those on that show again on January the 29th. Then 2 weeks after that, we will dive into our look at 1994 Donruss. So if you would like to make any suggestions for shows, a number of ways you can do that. You can comment on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains, and I've had a few interesting suggestions over the last few weeks that I'll look into. Also, you can email me, Matt Salmon Says, that's S-E-Z, full address, M-A-T-T-S-A-M-M-O-N-S-E-Z @gmail.com. And again, we'll take suggestions there as well. Also, donations are greatly appreciated. You've already made those tax-deductible donations to your favorite charity before the year ended. You can, if you have a few extra bucks, make a cash donation to Wax Ecstatic. Again, 100% of the proceeds you send to us goes right back into the show. It does not go into my personal bank account, doesn't feed my kids, doesn't feed my cats. It actually goes right back into the program in one of two ways. One, paying the fine folks at Audio Boom to keep our podcast online, as well as keeping our archives free and also available to download if you want to go scouring through that. And also it goes to purchasing the products that we discuss on this show. And if we ever have any excess product, that will go off to our friends at Commons for Kids. So any extra excess cards we get through random packs we purchase or through boxes and packs that we get, rack packs, cello packs, if we get a large allotment, we will pass along those to Commons for Kids, who do a great job in passing along not just baseball cards, in fact, not just sports cards, non-sports cards as well, to kids in need. There are plenty of kids in need, plenty of kids who just need something positive to look forward to. And what is more positive than getting a package of baseball cards or cards of different sports, your favorite teams, your favorite players when you're a youngster? Definitely a great cause, and I strongly encourage you to follow them and help them out too. You can follow them on Twitter at Commons for Kids. That's the number 4. And we certainly do our part in sending them some cards every few months. Now, also, just a heads up, we'll be looking at cleaning out my own personal closet here, too. So a couple of starter sets that I've started, but really have no good reason to start them because I've already completed them, such as a 1987 Topps hand-collated set. I do have a starter set of 1991 Topps. If you're just itching to start those sets yourself or add them to your own personal collection or break them up however way you wish, I will be posting that information on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. And just affixing a simple price, I know a lot of it is junk wax era stuff, so whatever price we agree to is mostly just going to cover shipping and handling. But that money, whatever you pay, whatever profit we get from that, again, will go right back into the program. Oh, one other way, if you want to make a direct cash contribution, we do have a PayPal link for you, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And again, any donation, even if it's $5, $10, goes a long, long way on this program. I am what the Boy Scouts would call thrifty. I am also what some people call frugal, a cheapskate, perhaps. But regardless of what you call it, I do look for some good value on what I purchase. So every donation, even if it is just a few bucks, goes a long way. And again, we appreciate cardboard donations, whether it's just something you want to gift me for my own personal assessment, that's great. Or if you want to donate some packs or some cards to discuss on the program, we'll take those as well. We've had a few shows based on donations given to us by fans. Again, reach me via email, mattsalmonsays@gmail.com, and we will take care of that. Now let's take care of business here with the 1991 Topps Archives set. This is one of those sets that I honestly regret not really taking a greater interest in when I was a child. And when this set came out, I was 12 going on 13. I was full steam ahead collecting baseball cards here. But in 1991, I was mostly buying whatever was new. And occasionally I would go to the local flea market or garage sale and I'd find that legitimate card from the 1950s or 60s or 70s that I would buy. But I didn't really have much of an appreciation for reprint sets. Well, looking back at the 91 Topps Archives set nowadays, I wish I did. Now, here's some good news, though. If you're like me and you wish you actually paid a little more attention to this, and you do want to collect this set, there are plenty of packs and boxes of 91 Tops archives out there, and they are pretty affordable. Because they were produced during the junk wax era, they were produced in large amounts, not quite 1991 Topps base set amounts, but still large enough to where even 30 years later, you can secure some for a relatively inexpensive price. You can get packs for basically 99 cents a piece. I think the six that I bought recently, I think they were originally priced at $12.99, but the eBay seller I got it from marked it down quickly to $8.99. So I paid, what, $1.25 a pack. So, you know, you can get these pretty inexpensive. I think I saw boxes going for about $35, which is about the going rate for any box from 1991 of value. And most of that is Stadium Club, Tops, Upper Deck, most other sets from 1991 you can get for far less for the cost of a wax box, simply because there were so many that were produced back then. But if you are somebody who wants to go out and either hand collate the set or even purchase a hand collated set, I've seen some hand collated sets going for, you know, $15. You're going to pay more for shipping than the actual set. Now, I am not going to go out and do this. In fact, the excess cards that I got from the two packs that I opened are going in the Commons for Kids box, and they will get sent out eventually. But the reason why I'm not doing it, as tempted as I am and as easy of a buy and a collection as it would be, I just, you know, again, I'm focused on taking care of some sets. I'm painfully close to completing my 84, 85, and 86 top sets, 77 as well. So I'm really focused on five or six sets that I'm trying to complete, or at least get a little closer to completion, so that I can start up a few more from the early 80s. Instead, I'd rather focus on that than, you know, starting another set. And by the way, 91 Tops Archives will be around for a while, so I'm not going to indulge in that right now. But this is one of those sets where if you wanted to get into it, it's a great set to do so, and it is affordable. Now, what makes 91 Tops Archives a great set? Well, I told you a little bit at the beginning of the program. It took the 1953 Topps set, not only recreated it, but also added to it, in a classy way. And this was very tough for Topps to do in 1991, because we all know what the big thing was in 1991, insert cards. Not only were card sets getting glossier, not only were they getting fewer cards in a pack, not only were you getting gold stamped cards and autographed cards and you know, all the other bells and whistles that were starting to get thrown into sets in the early 1990s, but, you know, Topps could have very easily started throwing in insert cards left and right into the packs and really just making this set a very bloated set. And that's actually one of the downsides to the heritage sets of nowadays. And if you've listened to this show, you know that I absolutely love the Topps Heritage releases every year. But, you know, there's a lot of inserts. Some of them are cool because, you know, they're based on what was originally inserted. For example, this upcoming release will be based on the 1972 Topps design. So whatever inserts, whether that be, cloth patches or tattoos or whatever, coins, whatever was inserted in the 1972 set will be in the 2021 Topps Heritage set. Well, in 1991, Topps did not do that. They basically stuck to just greatly improving the classic design. And they did it with just some minimal improvements. First of all, the 1991 Topps Archives set is based on the standard size of baseball cards now, the 2.5 inch by 3.5 inches. Now, that is smaller than what the original sets were. The 1953 Topps set was 2 5/8 inches by, 3 7/8. I may be off by 1/8 of an inch there. Forgive me. But, you know, the 1953 set was bigger, better, bolder. That was the standard size for baseball cards from 1952 to 1956. until they reverted to what is now the standard size of 2.5 inches by 3.5 inches in 1957. So that's a key way that you can tell one card from the other. You can lay one on top of the other. As we did in our video, if you didn't see the link yesterday, go to YouTube, type in Wax Ecstatic 1991 Topps Archives Break, and you'll see I take the 91 Topps Smokey Burgess card and lay it on top of the 1953 Topps Monty Irvin card. And you can see the size differential there. But other than making it shorter and printing the cards on the top notch cardstock that Topps was starting to use, first with Topps Stadium Club and then in 1992 with the Topps Base Set, you've got a great cardstock, which is a big improvement over what Topps was putting out in 1953. And you've got the glossy treatment. Now, the good thing about the Topps glossy treatment in 1991, it was not the UV coating that you see in a lot of cards that were released a little later on in the 90s, i.e. they're not sticking to each other. So that is a good thing, too. It was not caked on UV glossy coating. So, you know, nowadays when you open up a pack of cards from 92 or 93 with UV coating, they're often just stuck together and you peel them apart. And sometimes the coating peels off and you damage the card. Not the case with many, not all, but many of the Topps Archives cards from 1991. Now, other than having the cards at the standard card size, and having the glossy coating, the 91 Topps Archives cards are almost essentially the same as the 1953 Topps cards. So it's a great way, like I said earlier, to get your hands on. If you want a Jackie Robinson 1953 Topps card, gonna cost you a ton of money. If you find an ungraded 1991 Topps Archives Jackie Robinson card, it's only going to cost you maybe $3, $5, something along those lines there. And most of the common cards from the archive set, maybe a buck if somebody really wants to, you know, charge you a book value for them. So it's a great way to get what looks to be the real deal in your hands. And, you know, buying one for $15 or $20 online, as opposed to trying to buy the original 53 Topps set, which will only cost you, I don't know, $10,000 to accumulate. Yeah, you can see if you're somebody who is also thrifty, the archive set is a good option for you on that. So you have 273 of the original 274 cards. Who is the one holdout? Well, the one holdout is Billy Lowe's, which was card number 174 in the original set. Now, Topps honors Billy Lowe's by not issuing a Topps Archives card with number 174. So just beware of that. If you buy a hand collated set online and you're missing a card, don't leave negative feedback to the seller. There actually is a missing card number 174. Why is that? Because Billy Lowe's, who was a bit of a red ass as a ball player in the 1950s, did not grant Topps the right to use his likeness in the archive set. He was the only one. So Topps left him out. They left card number 174 out of the reprint set, and that's that. Now, Lowe's actually did this with another Topps product I'll get into in just a little bit, but that's just the one holdout in this particular set. Again, there are 57 cards featuring players who never were. So again, kind of the faux back, if you will, rookie cards for a lot of these players. Now, the biggest name is Hank Aaron, but you know, let me throw out some of the other names from this time that you may recognize. You have, Ralph Houk, also Bob Lemon, Joe Adcock, Frank Thomas, no, not the White Sox first baseman, the slugger for the Pittsburgh Pirates for many years. Also, Robin Roberts, you've got Rogers Hornsby. Let's see, Ralph Branca, who we're going to talk about later on in the program, Eddie Stanky, Sal Magley, Gil Hodges, Carl Erskine, Leo DeRocher, Richie Ashburn, Lou Burnett, Carl Fiorillo, Lou Boudreau, Ted Williams, and we'll get into why he wasn't in the original set. Also, some other great names here, Hoyt Wilhelm, Joe Garagiola, Casey Stengel, Don Newcomb. Just a ton of awesome names here. Larry Doby, Duke Snyder, Let's see who else. Bobby Thompson, Nellie Fox. The list goes on and on and on. And a lot of those were cards that Topps just didn't guess on. You know, some of these young players who were coming up, who were going to be phenomenal players, such as Hank Aaron, or a steady first baseman such as Gil Hodges. But a lot of it, too, has to deal with the contract squabbles that Topps had with certain players vis-a-vis with Bowman in the early 50s. Again, there was a very intense battle over contractual rights that Topps and Bowman had. So if Bowman had somebody under contract, they could not, or Topps could not issue a card for that player under contract with Bowman, and vice versa. So that was part of the tug of war, the legal battle that Topps and Bowman had throughout the early 1950s, which ultimately led to, it was one of the many reasons why Bowman had their demise, mostly because of just poor management and ownership. And also they just could not legally, financially keep up the battle with Topps for many, many years. Topps outgunned them in the courts and with expensive lawyers. But this went on back and forth for several years between these two teams, or these two manufacturers. So that's why you would have, you know, one star in one set, but not appearing in the other set. But that was one of the many reasons why Bowman eventually succumbed after the 1955 season, is because Topps got extremely aggressive with their contractual signings. They would go to spring training sites and they wouldn't just get the opening day roster. They would get the next 25 guys on the depth chart with these organizations. And they would just basically just stack up contracts so that Bowman, you know, over time just could not compete. Basically, Topps played the long game here and locked these guys into contracts, even if they really didn't have much of a chance of making it into the major leagues. Now, Ted Williams, one of those examples, too. He had an on-again, off-again relationship with Topps, and was also one of the reasons why Fleer had to pull one of the cards from their 1959 set, their ode to Ted Williams, because it featured a picture of Ted signing a contract. And Topps was able to finagle through the legal system. Wait a minute, this is something he's doing as a current player now, and as a current player of the Boston Red Sox, he's under contract with us. You pull this card, cease and desist. And that's why that one card from the Ted Williams Fleer set is worth so much more, and what bumped up the value of the set, because it was essentially a short print card that got pulled after getting released. So you had the contract squabbles back and forth between Topps and Bowman at that time. Fleer was a minor player later on in the decade. And that's why a lot of those players who were having cards that quote unquote never were finally did get that opportunity in 1991. By then, Topps had, you know, complete control of the Bowman name and basically the rights to these players' likenesses. So that's why they were included in this set. Now, I was telling you a little bit about another Topps Archives product that Billy Lowe's also held out on, and also four other players. This is a pretty neat little story, a little bit of a sidebar here to the 91 Topps set. And that is, in 1983, Topps released a reprint set of the 1952 set. And there were five players who held out from that set, so it's not a complete reprint. But there are sets still floating around of the 1952 Topps set that was released in the early 80s. Now, this was not as big of an effort from Topps to get the product out there. This set was released only through factory sets that were sold to hobby shops. So you had that pushed out there, but it also didn't get quite the promotion that a reprint set would, because obviously Topps was very much in a heated battle with Fleer and Donruss over the base sets that were coming out. This was the, you know, the very beginning of the rookie card craze of the 1980s, and a lot of attention, marketing, promotion was pointed towards getting that base set out there and the advantages of the base set over what Fleer and Donruss were putting out, because you also started having those subsets come out too. You had Topps Traded was starting to become bigger and bigger. Fleer would eventually create the update set the following year, but you also had, Donruss, the big cards, the opening day sets. So the archive reprint of the 1952 set didn't quite get the attention. And because it was only being sold wholesale through complete factory sets via hobby shops, not too many people knew about it unless you were a hobby shop owner or you frequented the hobby shop in 1983 and decided to invest in this. So I just want to let you know that if you're interested in the 1952 archive set that was released in the early 80s, those are still out there, but they are at much more of a premium for a couple of reasons. One, you've got the reprint of the legendary Mickey Mantle rookie card that's out there. So the reprint of the Mantle card is going to, reach a premium much higher than a common reprint card, but also at a lower price than the original card, obviously. But also because it was on somewhat of a limited production going wholesale through the hobby shops, it's not as widely dispersed as the 91 Topps archive set. So if you've got some extra coin just burning holes in your pockets and you don't want to give any of it to Wax Ecstatic, thank you very much, you can be on the lookout for these 1952 Topps reprint sets. They are still out there, but they will cost you a lot more than just a 91 Topps archive reprint of the 53 set. So I wanted to let you know that if you're a reprint aficionado, and like I said, you've got some extra cash and you want to go hunting for that, it is still out there. And by all accounts, they're still in great condition, albeit almost 40 years of age. But that is out there. And I wanted to tell you about that too, because there is a misconception that the 91 Topps archive set was the first archive set, the first reprint set, and that is not the case. Topps did attempt this with the 52 reprint, but on a much smaller rollout than what happened in 1991. Now, moving forward from there, how influential was the 91 Topps archive set? Well, as I said before, it was basically the harbinger of the Topps Heritage sets, which came out in the early 2000s and have been a big success ever since then. Now, what I like about the Topps Heritage sets is it pretty much, with the exception of all of the additional insert cards, pretty much sticks with what Topps was trying to do with the archive set in 1991, and that is stay true to the design, the look, the feel, the bonus tchotchkes that came in the original packs. So if you were opening a pack of 1953 Topps and the cards that you pulled out, granted, you only got a couple of cards in the pack because you were buying the packs for the bubblegum, not the cards necessarily. But, what you pulled out of the packs at that time, that is what you get in the 1953 archive reprints. Same thing with the Topps Heritage sets over the last 20 years. Let's say you're opening up, what is now a 2014 Topps Heritage pack. That was based on the 1965 Topps set. So the cards have the look, they have the feel, and again, whatever bonus things minus the gum that you got in the Heritage, in the original 1965 packs, you get in the Heritage sets. Now, you may recall Topps actually did package gum in some of these archive sets. Back was around 2007, 2008. It was a sugar-free gum. It was really disgusting. It was kind of fun to have gum and baseball cards side by side again, but then it wasn't once you actually chewed the gum. So I'm glad that Topps stopped that practice just out of nostalgia. But, still, generally speaking, the Heritage sets, the same look and feel of the cards using current players you get in the Heritage sets now. Also, what did the 1991 Topps archives do? Well, it helped basically put a foundation for what is the Topps Now set, the Living set, which has been going on and growing for a few years, utilizing mostly current players, but sometimes when Topps releases another four cards, maybe a player who was recently inducted into the Hall of Fame, or maybe a player who's been acknowledged for something they've done in their career, or maybe it's a player who's not in the Hall of Fame who had a great career who passed away. That'll be acknowledged by Topps with the Living set. And the living set has that 1953 Topps design. So while it's based on what was put out by Topps in 1953, there has to be a connection to the 91 Topps archive set. If Topps did not have any success with the archive set in 1991, hard to say that the Topps living set would be based on that design. Now, the archive's name still lives in Topps lore, albeit in a different form, as you've seen over the last several years with the archives packs. Basically, Topps is taking the stars of today and just randomly assigning some set from the past to design their card with. So you open up an archives pack, there's a card designed like 1974, the next card's like 1990, the next card's 1982. I've not been a big fan of the archive sets since, just because I think you're kind of overdoing the throwback design a little bit. And because it's such a random assortment, I personally am not a big fan of that. I'm more of staying true to the original design, look, and feel of the set that you're imitating. So that's why I like Topps Heritage. That's why I look forward to what Topps is going to do for the 2021 set and the design that will harken back to 1972. I thoroughly enjoyed what they did this past year with the 71 Topps design. And, you know, some great sets that were made in the 70s, you're going to see that parroted in upcoming Heritage sets. So I think Heritage kind of owes more, and of course the Topps Living set owes more to the 91 Topps archive experiment. And certainly the predecessor to that with the reprint of the 52 set in 1983, than what the currently branded archives sets have. So does that make sense here? We've got a lot of crisscrossing archive and heritage and reprints and living and dead and yeah. But I think you get my point here. 91 Topps Archives was very successful, not only because it stayed true to what 1953 Topps was doing, but it expanded it a little bit. You gave it a little bit of imagination with the 57 cards that never were, and it was a good jumping off point for what would become the Topps Heritage sets in the early 2000s. Now, another reason why 91 Topps Archives was so popular was it came at the right time. And this may be another reason why the 83 reprint of the 52 set didn't exactly take off. And we talk about 90s nostalgia nowadays. Well, in the early 1990s, there was definitely an itch for nostalgia of much of the 1950s and 1960s. As I've said before, this typically rolls around every 20 or 30 years. People just have a desire to throw it back to the good old days. And in 1991, that was certainly the case on a number of fronts. A lot of it has to do with, believe it or not, the Chicago White Sox and Comiskey Park. First, the White Sox prominently featured in the film Field of Dreams. The big hit with Shoeless Joe Jackson based on the W.P. Kinsella book called Shoeless Joe. Well, Shoeless Joe, of course, a member of the Chicago White Sox, and Kevin Costner stars in that film. It's a smashing success in 1989. So you've got people that are suddenly introduced to ball players and uniform designs and logos and how they played in the late teens and early 1920s. Coupled with that, you still had a lingering effect of the natural. Okay, Roy Hobbs, that film released a few years before Field of Dreams. So again, you've got this 1930s, 1940s era of baseball kind of lingering at that time. On top of that, you have the closing of Comiskey Park. So Comiskey Park's last season was in 1990. That was 80 years after the park opened in 1910. And the White Sox had a turn back the clock day in the 1990 season where they wore these throwback uniforms similar to what Shoeless Joe Jackson and the 1919 Chicago White Sox wore. And you see some of those uniforms in the 1991 sets, especially the 91 score set. There are a lot of Chicago White Sox players wearing those throwback uniforms. So now you have these throwback days, these turn back the clock days, which were not a regular feature of baseball games at that time. Certainly not to the extent of having the players wearing old uniforms. Maybe you had throwback pricing day, like a ticket was only $2 or a hot dog was only 25 cents. But for the most part, having both teams dress up in these old uniforms, that was not a normal occurrence prior to 1990. On top of that, you now have this nostalgia. As soon as the White Sox cross the parking lot into their new ballpark, Comiskey Park gets demolished. Now, granted, Comiskey Park by then was pretty much being held together by rat droppings and about 60 layers of white paint. But as soon as Comiskey Park sees the wrecking ball, then suddenly people realize, well, the old stadium was a hunk of junk, but that was our hunk of junk. And this new stadium, okay, it's new, it's modern, it's state of the art, but it's sterile. It really lacked a lot of the character that the old Comiskey Park had. So people are looking at this new park going, wait, why couldn't have it been designed a little bit like the old park? There's something missing here. So even though the White Sox were starting to become a pretty exciting young team, eventually they make the playoffs in 1993, and even the White Sox are donning the 1950s era uniforms, which they still do to this day, but it was a stunning change. And it also reflected the move to sports teams, thanks mostly to the Los Angeles Raiders, wearing black and silver and white. Now you've got this feverish pitch starting in Chicago for this yearning to go back in time. There were a lot of other things that were factoring into this, too. The White Sox weren't the only team doing turn-back-the-clock days. The San Francisco Giants had a turn-back-the-clock day where they donned uniforms from the 1920s New York Giants. So this was a bit of a surprise as well. Teams were starting to get into the whole turn-back-the-clock thing. On top of that, you had When It Was a Game coming out through HBO. So you have that archive home movie footage from the 1930s and 1940s, ushering in a whole new generation into how baseball used to be played. And granted, it used to be pretty much a slave and master system, but people through cheesecloth lenses went, oh, the players played for the love of the game. So people start getting caught up in that. And then as we start progressing into 1992, you kind of know the rest of the story, don't you? Oriole Park at Camden Yards opens up. And then on top of that, all of these other new stadiums start opening up with that throwback field. You've got Jacobs Field in Cleveland. You've got the new ballpark in Arlington, Texas. Coors Field, which was a brand new major league market, Denver, Colorado, opened up with this old-timey ballpark. And then all of a sudden, every ballpark afterwards had to have this throwback look to some kind of design from the 1940s or 1950s. And all of a sudden, people started, directly investing in not knocking down Fenway Park or not knocking down Wrigley Field, but actually investing money into saving these old stadiums. So even though Yankee Stadium would eventually see the wrecking ball, Fenway Park and Wrigley Field for the time being are still standing. So you can just imagine, or at least go back about 30 years and recall, yeah, there was a whole lot of nostalgia just gushing out around this time, be it because of movies like The Natural or Field of Dreams, or, Turn Back the Clock days, or retro style ballparks that came out. And I think that was a big help in boosting the hobby as well. Suddenly, there's this desire for collectors to go hunting down those cards from the 50s and 60s and 70s. And, it had always been there since the early 70s when, price guides were first put together and cards were actually being graded and there was a price tag affixed to them. But because of that nostalgia in the early 1990s, now you had nostalgia for the old cards, and all of a sudden all the old players are being sought out, and you're seeing these Hall of Famers, Mickey Mantle and Bob Feller and Ted Williams. Now they're showing up at card shows and, charging 50, 60, 100 bucks a head for autographs. And it was just this incredible groundswell of support and a desire to kind of turn back time and revisit not only the cards and not only the players, but the stadiums, the uniforms, you know, just everything from the past, it suddenly came flooding through in the early 1990s. So you talk about getting a pitch in the wheelhouse. Boy, Topps definitely found that in 1991 with the archive set. So again, I personally not going to invest my time and money in it right now, but I do strongly suggest that you take a look at it. Again, the 1991 Topps archive set, relatively easy to find. I should add that when it was originally released, it was only through hobby boxes, and there were only 18,000 cases produced. So there is some limit to the set. It wasn't produced as in large numbers as the base set or even Stadium Club that year. However, it is still plentiful for collectors. It is still relatively affordable. Like I said, I think I got mine for like a buck and a quarter a pack, which was the original MSRP for the packs. So you could still go out there and get boxes or get some individual packs for a cheap enough price. Or again, you can find some collectors who have hand collated those sets and they will sell them to you for a decent price. But it is a really fun set. It holds its own. It is very true to the original product, with the exception of the one Billy Lowe's card that's not in there. It's pretty much the real deal, plus a little bit of imagination tacked on. No, not through a bunch of tacky insert cards, but through 57 cards that never were, whether it be a rookie card like Hank Aaron, whether it be a player that was holding out because of a contract dispute like Ted Williams, or if it was a really unique story, such as a Hall of Fame inductee like Dizzy Dean or Eleanor Engel, the woman who was trying to play in professional baseball, a very unique addition, an update set, if you will, to a classic in the 1953 Topps set. So definitely check that out if you haven't already. It is one of those 90s nostalgia cards that may get overlooked because it's not based on a set from the 90s, but rather from 1953. Now, when you go through a pack of archives cards like this, you're going to find some legendary names and maybe a couple names you're not familiar with. And in the two packs that I opened up, I pulled out a couple of names from the original 1953 set and then a couple of cards as well that you may not recognize, including one that was one of the cards that never were. Now let's talk about one of the names that I'm sure you recognize, the Scooter, Phil Rizzuto, probably one of the biggest names that we pulled from our two packs here. And you probably know Phil Rizzuto in one of three ways. One, through many of the jokes on Seinfeld. Phil Rizzuto was often brought up in the program. Or through Phil Rizzuto as a color commentator on Yankees broadcast. He was in the Yankees booth for well over 30 years as a color announcer. And he was one of the first former athletes to turn a post-playing career into broadcasting, which is now pretty much the norm. Back in the 1950s when Rizzuto did this, this was not all that usual, but in his case it turned out to be kind of the foundation of having former athletes in a broadcast booth. Or the other way is if you watched cable TV in the 1980s or 1990s, you know where I'm going with this. Hi, Phil Rizzuto here for the Money Store. Yet you probably remember those commercials where Phil Rizzuto was, out there schlepping for the Money Store, which was one of those, payday advance loan companies. And boy, they had their advertisements everywhere in the 80s and 90s. So you may remember Phil Rizzuto for that. Actually, another way, if I can throw in the fourth option, another way that you may know of Phil Rizzuto is if you have heard, and who hasn't, the 1978 classic hit song from Meatloaf. Yes, the A Paradise by the Dashboard Lights. There is a Phil Rizzuto cameo in that song, which we'll get to in just a little bit. Let's talk a little bit about Philip Francis Rizzuto, born September 1917, a native of Brooklyn, New York. His father was a streetcar motorman. Now, I mentioned that because one of the other players that we're going to talk about, his father was a streetcar motorman, although I don't believe in Brooklyn. But regardless, born presumably in 1917, although there are some rumors that he was actually born in 1918, just to shave a year off of his eligibility, you know, to make him appear younger than he actually was, although it seems that he was actually born in 1917, that per his official birth certificate. So we'll go ahead and lean on that. Now, he was called the Scooter because he was naturally a very fast-running ball player. And a lot of it is because of his, how we nowadays call his undersizedness, for lack of a better term, often listed at 5'6", about 150 pounds, plus or minus a few pounds, maybe an inch. But he was your prototypical middle infielder. Undersized, didn't have the biggest bat in the world, however, was defensively solid and often came through in the clutch, either at the plate or on the base paths. So he got his nickname, the Scooter, through one of his teammates who noted that he scooted around the bases rather quickly. And he was not only a baseball star in high school, but also football as well. Now, rumor is when he was trying out for the local ball clubs in the late 1930s, the New York Giants told him that he would never have a career in Major League Baseball, and perhaps he could be, you know, a good, successful shoe shinesman. Now, that was reportedly said by Casey Stengel, but that's been refuted since, because Stengel was not a member of the Giants at that time. But suffice to say, the Giants certainly looked down on Phil Rizzuto. They just thought he was too small, just didn't have enough talent, and was not going to cut it. Well, that was certainly not the case with the New York Yankees, who in 1937 did sign him, and he was able to work his way up through the Yankees farm system and made his major league debut on April 14th, 1941, replacing the well-known and well-liked Crow, Frank Crosetti. Crosetti was starting to decline on the field, so Rizzuto quickly comes on board, is a great tandem partner with Joe Gordon over at second base, and he was won over very quickly by the Yankee fans and the Yankee management, despite a rather lackluster 1941 World Series performance, as the Yankees did beat the rival Brooklyn Dodgers in that series. Now, he did, however, have a pretty solid 1942 series against the St. Louis Cardinals, and like many players in his time, had to go overseas and serve in World War II. He was a member of the Navy from 1943 through 1945, didn't see any combat, was actually part of a baseball team that was managed by Bill Dickey, had Dodger shortstop Pee Wee Reese as a teammate. That was the case with a lot of ball players, not all. Certainly, you look at the Ted Williams story, you know that's not the case. But in the case of Phil Rizzuto, he did not see much action, and was actually, in many ways, part of a goodwill team of roving ball players with the United States Navy. Now, after he was released from the Navy in 1945, he comes back over to the States, ready to play in 1946, but runs into some trouble. In 1946, there were some investors and some former ball players who were starting a rival league in Mexico, and they were recruiting major league ball players. And they had reportedly offered a pretty sizable deal to Rizzuto to join the Mexican league. And Rizzuto was reportedly very interested in doing so because, first of all, the Yankees were not paying very well, but also post-war life in Mexico was much more productive than in the United States. And that's because there was a recession that was about to take place. All of a sudden, the industrial machine that helped America fight the Nazis and the Japanese in World War II, that suddenly came to a stop. So jobs were not plentiful. The economy was stuttering a little bit here. And playing in Mexico, it's a little warmer than the Bronx, right? So he considered that option, but long story short, after the Yankees very aggressively sought a litigious action to not only stop Rizzuto and teammates from going to Mexico, but to stop the Mexican League, he decides to stay over in New York and would continue to play for the Yankees for many years. Like I said, he was a clutch ball player, was solid defensively for a long time, held the American League record for errorless games, error-free streak for a shortstop. It was at 50 games. Like I said, he held that for a very long time. He was the most valuable player in the American League in 1950. Following a runner-up performance in 1949, following Ted Williams. He also was the only MVP in history who led the league in sacrifice bunts. Rizzuto was a top-notch bunter, not only because he could get the bat on the ball just right, but because of that speed. He could not only reach first base safely, but also place that ball perfectly to help advance runners. In fact, was a key part to the Yankees when they did call for a suicide squeeze. He could definitely get that in play there. Again, defensively, a solid player here, was just locking up the middle of the infield for many, many years for the Yankees, came through in the clutch with numerous hits, and was part of that Yankee domination from 1949 to 1953 when they won the World Series every year, was part of the Yankee team that lost to the Dodgers in 1955. And in 1956, he's playing along with the Yankees. His numbers are slipping just a little bit. However, in a surprise move, August 25th, 1956, he is released by the Yankees. And he finds out that he was going to be the odd man out while he is, having a conversation with the Yankees management. The Yankees trying to make room for Ina Slaughter, who was coming back for another stint with the team. And Rizzuto, much to his surprise, finds out he's the guy that's going to get cut. And here he is at the end of the season. The Yankees, again, driving to a pennant. They're going to play in the World Series in 1956, as it would turn out. And here he is left, hung out to dry with about a month left in the season. Now, this is where a crucial part of Phil Rizzuto's life comes into play. And we've actually talked about this before, because the player who gave him some good advice was actually one of our random players that we discussed when looking back at the 1950 and 1951 Bowman cards. We did that a little over a year ago. And that was a gentleman by the name of George Snuffy Sternweiss, who was a close friend of Rizzuto, actually considered playing the Mexican League as well. Well, Rizzuto obviously is pissed off at the Yankees that they cut him with a month left to go in the season, and he still felt that he was still a decent ball player at the time. So Rizzuto wants to go to the press and just rip the Yankees into what they're doing. Well, Sternweiss gives him some very stern advice, if you will. He says, hey, don't say anything about this. Keep your mouth shut, because you never know how the Yankees are going to come back and help you down the line here. So Rizzuto takes that advice. He bites his lip and just kind of lets the cards kind of play out there. And it worked out magnificently, because he was able to start a broadcasting career with the Yankees. So Rizzuto, in September 1956, fills in as a color announcer for the rival Giants. Their host, Frankie Frisch, had suffered a heart attack. So Rizzuto comes in, fills in a pinch, gets great reviews. And now all of a sudden, the Yankees are in a bind. Not just because the Giants know how talented Rizzuto is as a broadcaster, but a demo tape is sent to the Baltimore Orioles. So the Orioles are considering hiring Phil Rizzuto as a broadcaster. And then the Yankees sponsor, Ballantine Beer, catches wind of this, and they go to the Yankees and say, hey, you're about to lose this guy to the Orioles. So George Weiss, who was the general manager of the Yankees, had to fire color commentator Jim Woods for no good reason. In fact, Weiss would say this many years later, he was the only person, Woods, the only person Weiss ever fired for no good reason at all. So they had to do that to keep Phil Rizzuto in Yankee pinstripes, so to speak. And he would start a 40-year career as a color announcer and sometimes as play-by-play announcer, because back then they often just flipped roles, color announcer and play-by-play announcer. And they still do that in many radio booths. But he would become the voice of the New York Yankees for decades. Now, he was the voice who called the play-by-play of Roger Maris hitting his 61st home run in October of 1961. He was also part of the local television call of Chris Chambliss hitting the series-winning home run in the 1976 ALCS. Just a lot of great moments that Verzuto was able to be part of because he kept his mouth shut after getting cut by the Yankees rather ruthlessly in September of 1956. Best advice that he could have taken. In 1985, the Yankees retired his number 10 appropriately with a cow wearing a halo nearby, a real cow, hence the holy cow, which was kind of the catchphrase for Phil Verzuto for many years. And he was just a legend with the Yankees for a very long time afterwards. Now, his career as a broadcaster would end in 1996, and he would continue to be a prominent part of Yankees old-timers days and is still the subject of many arguments over who was the better shortstop, Phil Rizzuto or Derek Jeter. Of course, you'll have a lot of people who will lean towards the latter of the two when having that discussion. Phil Rizzuto passed away in August of 2007. In fact, August 13th, it was 12 years to the day that his former teammate Mickey Mantle had passed away. And Rizzuto had been battling a number of illnesses for the previous few years. Now, one other quick footnote about Phil Rizzuto. I mentioned the Paradise by the Dashboard Light story. There's been a lot of stories that when they brought Rizzuto in for the recording of the session, for the play-by-play, if you will. And of course, if you get the song, the play-by-play isn't of a baseball game. It's a guy in the backseat of his car putting the moves on his woman. Supposedly, Rizzuto didn't really know what he was getting into, and he just read it, and that was that. But Meatloaf actually says no. Rizzuto knew exactly what he was getting into. He just played dumb for many of years because Rizzuto was a devout Catholic, had a lot of connections with the Catholic Church. Some priests, when they found out about the song, were horrified by it. And of course, he was also very well aware of what his wife would have thought of had he willingly, knowingly went into the sound booth to record this. Of course, talking about Cora Rizzuto, who he was married to for over 60 years. It was 64 years, I want to say. So there's a lot of he said, she said with that story, but a lot of people do believe that Phil Rizzuto actually knew what he was getting into. It was a little wink, wink when he got into the recording studio to do that. And the rest, as they say, is history. It's still one of the best parts of that song. And as somebody who worked in classic rock radio and who heard that song a gazillion times, one of the few reasons why I enjoy hearing Paradise by the Dashboard Lights is because of that Phil Rizzuto cameo calling the play-by-play of said Paradise by the Dashboard Lights. Now let's move on to another legendary New York player, although legendary for all the wrong reasons, but a guy who handled his brush with infamy with all sorts of class. We're talking about Ralph Branca. Now, this was one of the cards that never was in the 1953 set, but it was recreated in the 91 Topps Archives set. Ralph Branca, born in Mount Vernon, New York. He was the 15th of 17 children, born in January 1926. His father, much like Phil Rizzuto's father, also a trolley car conductor, believe it or not. And he was a second generation American here. His father was actually born in Italy, his mother from Slovakia. And they came to the United States in 1901 and had a very fruitful family life, as you can see, with 17 children, Ralph being the 15th of number 17. Now, he graduated from Davis High School, attended New York University for 1 year, excelling not only in baseball, but also basketball with NYU, but then joined the big leagues. Now, as he's able to do, he was able to play professional ball during World War II because he was exempt from military service due to asthma, also a punctured eardrum. He got a tryout with the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1943 and was quickly signed to a contract, of course, with many current ball players serving overseas. Players like Branca were very quickly moved up to the major leagues. He made his debut at the age of 18 in June of 1944. Now, opening day 1947, that was the beginning of Jackie Robinson's career. Ralph Branca defying a lot of what racists were saying about Jackie Robinson and his place in Major League Baseball when the teams were lining up on the field. It was Ralph Branca who was standing right beside Jackie Robinson during opening day announcements. So a lot of people remember Pee Wee Reese, the arm around Jackie Robinson, helping ushering in him as a member of not only Major League Baseball, but the Brooklyn Dodgers, but Ralph Branca also having a very important part of that transition as well. Branca would go 21-12 in 1947, a 2.67 earned run average, and everyone was looking at him to be a big star in 1948, and he would continue to excel as he had 14 wins in 48, also had the best win-loss percentage in 1949 with the Dodgers, and had a pretty respectable 1951 season as well, a three-time All-Star with the Dodgers from 1947 through 1949. Now, the legendary moment, of course, Ralph Branca in the bullpen in the Polo Grounds along with Carl Erskine. It's game three of the best of three playoff series between the Dodgers and the Giants to determine the National League pennant, the team that would go on to face the Yankees in the 1951 World Series. While Dodger coach Clyde Sukeforth is watching what's going on in the bullpen, and he sees Erskine's bouncing a bunch of curveballs in the dirt, so he's not feeling so confident about Erskine, so he tells manager Chuck Dressen, call on Ralph Branca. So even though Branca had been homered off of by Bobby Thompson in game one of the series, the Dodgers turn to Branca, and he comes out on the mound to face Bobby Thompson once again. Now, it is well regarded that the Giants were stealing signs. It was a relatively easy thing for them to do from the Polo Grounds with the clubhouse in deep center field. So no surprise that Thompson knows that there's a fastball coming. He launches it into the left field stands. The shot heard round the world. Russ Hodges, the legendary, the Giants win the pennant call. And the Giants do indeed win the pennant. And Ralph Branca is now hurled into the realm of goats. No, not greatest of all times, more the barnyard animal. And he is on the short stick of infamy because he gives up this home run to Ralph Branca. Despite the fact that Carl Erskine is bouncing curveballs in the bullpen and the Giants are stealing signs, Branca's just kind of tagged with this loser ID for a long time, which is unfortunate. Now, 1951 ended roughly, unfortunately for Branca. 1952 did not start out as well either. In fact, he had a very bizarre back injury. The story goes that he was in spring training. He's playing Monopoly in the team clubhouse and somehow falls off a chair, lands on a Coke bottle, and that writhing of the back muscles somehow throws his back out. Now, sports medicine, nowhere near as sophisticated in 1952 as it is today. So he's misdiagnosed, mistreated, and his game really suffers. He only appears in 16 games in the Dodgers in 1952, did not appear in the 52 World Series. And he was actually waived by the Dodgers in July of 1953, picked up by the Detroit Tigers, the team that he is featured with in this card that was never done in 1953. So he bounces around, again, dealing with poor physical management from team doctors and physicians, and just cannot find the magic that he had with the Dodgers in the late 40s. Plays for the Tigers in 1953 and 54. Plays for the Yankees in 1954. And, you know, after the 1954 season, thinks that his career is over. He plays some ball with the Minneapolis Millers in 1955, is dealing with injuries, gets released from the team, thinks that it's all done. Well, that's not the case, as he had a rather unique return to baseball, a very brief one. But during the 1956 Old-Timers game at Yankee Stadium, he shows up, he's wearing pinstripes, he's throwing in the game. Suddenly he discovers, hey, I've kind of got that touch back. And with the Brooklyn Dodgers dealing with all sorts of injuries and just kind of scuffling their way, fighting the Cincinnati Reds, the St. Louis Cardinals, the Milwaukee Braves for the National League pennant that year, Buzzy Bavasi needs an arm. So he goes out and he signs Ralph Branca. Now, there are some stories. Bavasi says that he just wanted Branca to retire as a Dodger, but many people will say, no, they needed a healthy arm. And Branca did make an appearance late in the season. He pitched a couple of innings, got the Dodgers out of a jam, and helped the Dodgers win the National League pennant in 1956. And that was it. That was then the end of his playing career, as he was able to wrap it up in 1956. Now, he did have an opportunity after playing with the Dodgers in 1956 to play for the team in 1957, but he didn't make the team. He also had an opportunity to become a coach with the Los Angeles Angels of the Pacific Coast League. He decided not to go out to Los Angeles because he just didn't feel like moving out to California. So that was that. He became a game show star. It's interesting because, you know, he's so tied into Phil Rizzuto. Not only their fathers being operators on trolley cars, Phil Rizzuto was the first mystery guest on What's My Line in 1950. Believe it or not, Ralph Branca would be a game show star as well, where he appeared on 17 consecutive games of Concentration in 1963. He was the Ken Jennings of Concentration back then. He appeared on the TV show's Challenge of Champions that season as well. Now, also during this time, he's still dealing with the fallout of giving up that home run to Bobby Thompson, but he took it in great stride. In fact, he and Thompson became good friends, and talk about the autograph, you know, routines going on starting in the 1990s, where a lot of former players were brought to card shows to sign autographs. Often, Thompson and Branca would appear at card shows together, so people could get baseballs or bats or pictures signed by both of them, and just a lot of class that Branca dealt with, you know, what could have been just this totally demoralizing moment in sports history. He just took it in stride. You know, he was part of it. He gave up the home run. Yeah, the Giants were stealing the signs, but he was able to actually make a living for many, many years doing that. So he never looked down on his time after giving up that home run, and that was rather fortunate for him, as he was, like I said, able to, you know, make it, you know, off the money of card shows for many years. He was also a pretty solid singer, sang publicly, was a devoted poet as well, and like I said, was a big hit on the classic Concentration show in the mid-1960s. Now, while Phil Rizzuto and Ralph Branca are well-known, one of the cards I pulled from the packs here features a player who is not as well-known, and it's simply because he played for some really bad teams, a lot of second-division teams in the 1950s, and that really steals from the story of Gus Zernial. And I learned about Gus Zernial reading Bill Veeck's autobiography, Veeck as in Wreck. He really loved Zernial when he was in charge of the Cleveland Indians, and was actually a big reason, you know, why Zernial got, you know, moved around a little bit throughout the 1950s. If Veeck couldn't afford him or make a deal, he would tell other general managers, hey, you've got to get this guy. And that certainly worked out well for their teams, even though, again, generally speaking, the teams that Zernial played for were not very good. He was born in Beaumont, Texas, June of 1923, had a very, very tough upbringing, lost several siblings to illness in the 1920s, lost his father at a very young age, his mother, the rock of the family, a big positive reinforcement for Zernial as was baseball. He watched the local semi-pro team in Beaumont, the Beaumont Exporters, which featured a few future ball players, including Hall of Famers Hank Greenberg and Hal Newhouser. So he was a big fan of the game as a youngster and starred in baseball as well as basketball and football at Beaumont High School. He lettered in all three sports. He was also captain of the basketball team as a senior and was offered a scholarship to Baylor, also Oklahoma and Texas. But because of the death of his father, he felt he wasn't ready to go to college and was going to just get a job as a working man. Well, in 1941, Zerniello was signed by the St. Louis Cardinals and starts moving up their farm system. But again, his playing career cut short because of the war. So he also enlists in the Navy, was a Navy operator aboard several battleships in the Pacific, and he also played ball as well at the Naval Base in San Francisco. Now, during this time, too, you have a lot of downtime when you're not in battle. So he turned to weight training and actually put on 210 pounds to his body. 6 feet, 2.5 inches tall, 210 pounds. The man was pure muscle, and he eventually became a power hitter and left the military in October of 1945. So once again, he goes into the minor leagues and through a series of transactions gets claimed by the Chicago White Sox in 1947. Now, even though the White Sox claim him, they option him out to the Hollywood Stars of the Pacific Coast League. And you can just imagine this strapping, muscular man living in Hollywood, California with his wife playing baseball. The guy's just having a whale of a time playing in the Pacific Coast League. And it was actually in the HBO documentary When It Was a Game where Zerniello said that he actually took a pay cut to eventually join the major leagues. The Hollywood Stars were paying twice what the Chicago White Sox were paying him in 1949, but he wanted the option to play in Major League Baseball, and he was able to do that in 1949. Now, in 1951, he is traded by the White Sox to the Philadelphia Athletics for Minnie Mignoso. Of course, Mignoso would become a big star with the White Sox, but in Philadelphia, Zerniello would lead the league in home runs, RBI, extra base hits, and defensively, he was pretty solid too with 17 assists in the outfield. He also hit 29 homers and 100 RBI in 1952 and followed that up in 1953 with 42 homers and 108 RBI. The problem is, again, being with the Philadelphia Athletics, a second division team, not too many people really noticed what was going on there at the time. So even though he was a solid contact and power hitter, he often went under the radar in Philadelphia. When the team moved to Kansas City, that was the same situation there. And by 1957, he's eventually traded to the Detroit Tigers, where he plays just a couple more seasons. Now, he had some very interesting honors, many of them involving players with the last name that starts with Z. I won't go through that entire list of honors there. But he was the first major leaguer to hit 4 home runs in the month of October during the regular season. That's been accomplished only once since by Ron Kittle in 1985. He also became the first player to hit 3 home runs in the final game of a season. Dick Allen would do the same thing in 1968, and then teammates Evan Longoria and Dan Johnson did that in 2012. And then, let's see, what else did he do? Oh yeah, he had a pretty unique baseball card in 1952, a Topps card featuring him holding a bat with 6 baseballs attached to it. That was to recognize that he hit 6 home runs in 3 consecutive games in May of 1951. He would hit his 7th home run in 4 consecutive games the day after that picture was taken. And he is also known for teeing up a well-hit opportunity here. He was being featured in a movie studio publicity shot with Marilyn Monroe. Supposedly, after this photo op was done, Joe DiMaggio was struck at just how gorgeous Marilyn Monroe was. Was a little jealous that Zerniello had the chance to be in her proximity and was able to, through Zerniello, get in touch with Marilyn Monroe. And, you know, the rest is certainly history there with the rather short marriage of Monroe and the rather private Joe DiMaggio. Now, other than being matchmaker for Joe DiMaggio's O'Neill after his playing days were over in 1960, where he did get a couple of offers to play from the Dodgers, the Red Sox, the Pacific Coast League, which at then was starting to die as a major league, he instead became a TV sportscaster, in fact, a very influential sportscaster in Fresno, California, play-by-play broadcaster for a TV station that covered a lot of Fresno State University games. He retired at the station in 1976, later became a member of a marketing agency, also a leasing manager for a local Pontiac dealership, and also offered financial services through a company they started in the 1990s. He was very influential in helping get a new ballpark built in Fresno, and was a big part of the Fresno Grizzlies early days in the mid-1990s. In fact, he was a part of the broadcast team through 2003. He was a cancer survivor. He was diagnosed with that in 1990, was able to battle through that, survive that, and he lived all the way until January 20th, 2011, after he passed away following a long illness. Last but not least, we've got another player who was very influential, a well-known ball player who became better known as a rather effective manager, and who almost 60 years after his death is still providing a very positive influence to many people around the world. Talking about Hutch, Frederick Charles Hutchinson, and we've got his card in one of these packs as well. He was a much ballyhooed pitching prospect coming out of the Seattle area in the late 1930s. There was a bidding war for him, and we'll get to that in just a moment. First born in the Seattle area in 1919, shortly after his parents relocated to the area, he was a son of a doctor and one of four children, the oldest of four children. And he, like I said, was an outstanding ball player, not just as a pitcher, but also as a first baseman, a catcher, an outfielder. You could just put him anywhere. And he led the local ball team, the Quakers, to a number of American Legion titles in the early 1930s. So he was starting to play semi-pro ball in 1937, eventually signs with the Seattle Rainiers in 1938, and at the age of 19, captures baseball scouts' attention everywhere as he wins 25 games as a pitcher and was named the Sporting News Minor League Player of the Year. So after he's named Sporting News Minor League Player of the Year, a bunch of teams are tripping over their feet trying to sign Hutchinson, including the Yankees, also the Pittsburgh Pirates. Eventually, the Detroit Tigers are the team that are victorious, not only paying him cash, but also working out a deal with the Seattle Rainiers for some players as well. Now, when Hutchinson made his major league debut, he really struggled, and he was also unknowingly part of one of the most interesting, dare I say, bizarre major league debuts. He made his major league debut on May 2nd, 1939 at Briggs Stadium in Detroit. What made this game so unusual? Lou Gehrig would not be in the lineup. That's right. It was this game that Lou Gehrig's 2,130 consecutive game streak ended. And the Yankees, without Gehrig and Joe DiMaggio in center field, they were fired up. They were going to win one for their teammates, and they eventually just clobbered the Tigers 22-2. And yes, Fred Hutchinson was part of that absolute drubbing at the hands of the Yankees. So quite the way to make your major league debut. He did struggle quite a bit in the 1939, 1940, and 41 seasons. He eventually went to the minor leagues and went back and forth between the major leagues and minor leagues throughout those seasons there. And like many of his cohorts at that point in time, had to enter military service. He too was in the U.S. Navy from 1942 to 45. He did see active duty and actually became a lieutenant commander before the end of his military service in 1945. So after the military, it's 1946. He's 26 going on 27, and he was able to get back into the prime pitching that he had in the late 1930s in Seattle as he was part of the starting staff for the Detroit Tigers in 1946. And also started a nice stretch of six straight seasons with 10 or more wins. He had 18 in 1947, 17 in 1950, was an All-Star in 1951, which was rather appropriate as Briggs Stadium hosted the All-Star game that year, despite the American League losing to the National League that year. And he would continue to have an outstanding record as a major league pitcher. All with the Detroit Tigers, his playing days ended up wrapping up in 1953, although under some unique situations and circumstances. But his numbers, 95 and 71, 3.73 earned run average, and a pretty solid strikeout to walk ratio, a ton of complete games as well. And like I said, an All-Star in 1951. Now, what happened with Hutchinson going from player to manager? In fact, he's featured on this card as a manager. Well, late in the 1952 season, Hutchinson is starting to decline as a pitcher. And as the Tigers are struggling at the same time too, they fired their manager, Red Rolfe, and name Hutchinson as a player manager. Very unusual to have a pitcher player manager. But because Hutchinson was such a natural leader, they figured, okay, this is the guy that can kind of take the reins here and let's see what he can do with it. And he helped the Tigers improve, albeit gradually, from eighth place in 1952 to fifth place finishes in 1953. In 1954, he was also the manager of the Tigers when Al Kaline made his debut to the major leagues. Now, the Tigers, under new ownership, offered a two-year contract or offered a one-year contract for Hutchinson in 1955. He wanted a two-year contract, couldn't get it. So the Tigers say, okay, thanks, but no thanks. He leaves the Tigers, goes back to Seattle, and he manages the Seattle Rainiers. Now, he leads them rather successfully in 1955, a first-place finish. And the St. Louis Cardinals, looking for a new manager, hire him in. He replaces Harry the Hat Walker as the manager in 1956. Has an immediate impact on the Cardinals in 1956. They're in the pennant race with the Dodgers that year. In 1957, they're chasing the Milwaukee Braves throughout the 1957 season. The Braves do hold on to win the pennant in 1957 and 1958. But through Hutchinson's leadership, through his hard-driving, very in-your-face, matter-of-fact, forceful leadership, he's able to push the Cardinals to do some great things and fall just a little short of winning those pennants in each year. Now, even though he is pushing the Cardinals to success here, he unfortunately did not win the good graces of management. And eventually the players, too, grew tired of his managerial process. So late in September of 1958, he is pushed out as the manager of the Cardinals and is back in Seattle managing the Rainiers once again, also serving as the club's general manager. Now, the team is not doing as well in 1959. However, the Cincinnati Reds in need of a new manager as they're stumbling out of the gate in the 1959 season, go out and hire Hutchinson as their manager at the All-Star break. The team is 10 games under 500, and in the second half of the season, the team finishes four games above 500 and actually moves up a couple of spots in the standings. 1960, the Reds are even better than they were before in 1959. And then going into 1961, the Reds surprised the world as they win the National League pennant and challenge the Yankees in the 1961 World Series as they push the Yankees to the brink, to the very end of the season here. Unfortunately, the Yankees, the 61 Yankees, you got Mantle, you got Maris, you just have this incredible team that won 109 games that year, and the Yankees would prevail in five games. Now, because of that success in 1961 and also under new ownership, Hutchinson very quickly wins the hearts and minds of everybody in Cincinnati. So he gets a longer-term contract as a manager. And in 1962, Reds finish in third place. Unfortunately, in 1963, they fall to fifth place. And then going into the 1964 season, tragedy strikes. December 1963, Hutchinson's at his home in Anna Maria Island, Florida. He discovers a lump on his neck, and he goes to Seattle to get it checked out. And they find several malignant tumors in his lungs, his chest, and his neck. Now, Hutchinson was a chain smoker galore back then. He actually was reportedly smoking four packs a day. And because of this aggressive smoking, because of the aggressive cancers, and because cancer, killing of the cancers at the time was such a new process and very primitive compared to how you aggressively treat cancer these days, he basically had no chance. He goes public with his diagnosis in January of 1964, undergoes treatment, but still is able to manage the Cincinnati Reds through much of the 64 season. Unfortunately, he has to hang it up August 12th, 1964, turns over managerial duties for good to first base coach Dick Sisler. And then he would unfortunately pass away on October 19th at Manatee Memorial Hospital in Bradenton, Florida. The Cincinnati Reds retired his number, the number one. He was also posthumously named Man of the Year by Sport Magazine in 1964 for a courageous battle against cancer. And Major League Baseball gives out the Hutch Award every year in memory of Fred Hutchinson. But that's not where the story ends. You're thinking, man, that's a real bummer of a note there. But Fred Hutchinson's life continues to give to this day. Thanks to family members, especially a brother who was a doctor in Seattle, the Cincinnati Reds help push this, and his brother pushed this as well. The Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center is created in 1965, and the Fred Hutchinson Cancer Research Center became a major cancer treatment hub. It was an independent hub, but all these decades later, continues to be a major part of cancer research and beating cancer, not only in medical, but also in the baseball world. That's where John Lester went for cancer treatment back in 2006 through 2008. And the legend of Fred Hutchinson not only continues through the Cancer Research Center, not only continues through Major League Baseball awards, not only continues through his induction into the Cincinnati Reds Hall of Fame in 1965, but if you go to T-Mobile Park in Seattle, and I didn't know this, I've actually been to T-Mobile Park. If you go to T-Mobile Park in Seattle, if you look at the end plate on the rows of seats, you will see there is a pitcher in his pitching motion on those end plates. That picture, that end plate, was based on photographs of Fred Hutchinson pitching. So almost 60 years after his death, Fred Hutchinson is still very much alive and well and contributing, not only in the Seattle area, where he was named the athlete of the 20th century for Seattle by the Seattle Post-Intelligencer back in 1999, not only in the Seattle area, through the ballpark and through the Cancer Research Center, but all throughout the nation of Major League Baseball, Fred Hutchinson is still very much a part of everything that is happening in Major League Baseball. And I think that's incredible for a guy who was described as a hard-ass manager, but a guy who got results. Kind of think of him as Lou Piniella in the day, a guy who bristled a lot of people, but was able to push a lot of teams to do very well. Fred Hutchinson, even though he was a little controversial, and even though he had a very brief, albeit successful, major league career, still, almost 60 years later, still a vital part of the baseball community and the medical community. And that's just a really awesome story there. And it's a great way to wrap up a look back at an awesome set, the 1991 Topps archive set. again, in somewhat limited numbers, but still readily available at affordable prices. I do recommend you buy a few packs, at least check it out, or put together a set, buy a hand-collated set. It is a great way to look back at not only the legendary 1953 set, sans Billy Lowe's, but also a great way to look at the cards that never were, some other notable names and faces from the 1953 season in that extension of the original set, and a great way to have a 1953 set without having to pay the prices of the original 1953 set. And again, reprint cards, well, I was never a huge fan of them, and I don't go out of my way for them. Whether it's the 91 Topps archive set, whether it was future Topps archive sets, or the Topps heritage sets, the Topps living sets, or maybe just a book of reprint cards. There's nothing wrong with the reprint cards. A, it puts a reasonable facsimile of a real card from that era in your hands, if you so choose. And B, if you are a fan of those cards, they're nice to collect, they're nice to showcase, they're great to get autographs on. And they're just a nice little addition to the legitimate original release cards in your set. So that's our look at 1991 Topps Archives, a throwback, not the first throwback set for Topps, but the first really influential throwback set that launched a lot of other products over the years, but also helped baseball fans and card collectors really soak in the nostalgia that was just gushing forward in the early 1990s for the quote-unquote simpler days of baseball in the 40s, 50s, and 60s. It was the right place, the right time, the right product, too, and it all comes together real nicely. Even 30 years later, it still stands above a lot of the other cards that were released at that time. All right, that'll wrap it up for this week's program. Again, if you would like to make a contribution, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic for cash contributions. Cardboard donations, too. Email me, mattsalmonsays@gmail.com. Let me know what you're thinking. If it's something we can utilize on the show, we'll certainly work out a deal to get it in my hands. And also, make sure you comment on our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains. If you're listening on a platform such as Apple Podcasts that allows you to rate and review the program, please do. Positive reviews are always appreciated. Negative reviews will be mocked. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. Join us 2 weeks from today, Friday, January 15th. We'll take a look back at the 1993 Donruss set. And until then, wear those masks, wash those hands, continue to social distance. We're not done with the fight against coronavirus just yet. We're getting there, but we still need your cooperation. And let's make sure that you're entering the year 2022 healthy, wise, strong, like we're entering 2021. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.